You know, we don't like to hurt, but there are some things that just hurts. It has to hurt. And there's some good things that occur because of hurt. I read an article recently that was on the Fox News website by a young man, 31 years old, and I can't recall the exact condition, but he had a neurological condition that he can feel no pain. Anywhere in his body, he can't feel any pain. And there was a name for this particular syndrome and so forth. And you might think, well, that sounds like that would be a pretty good deal, to not have any pain, to not have any hurt, right? I mean, we don't like to hurt. We take pills when we do hurt, and we go see the doctor if it hurts so much that the pill won't take care of you. We get that addressed. But as he described his story, he said the problem is he has no sensitivity when he's hurting. So if he touches something that's scalding hot, whereas we would immediately pull our hand back, he doesn't have that sensitivity. So he was detailing all of the injuries that's occurred to him because of his inability to feel pain. And he was describing what a hardship this was. Well, in the physical realm, we understand it may not be enjoyable, but pain does serve a purpose. And we're going to talk tonight, as we go through this book, and I intend to go through all five of these lamentations that are set before us here in this book. And I've entitled it "When Life Hurts," and we're just going to look at it in that case. Now, this is a book I understand for many of us is not familiar. I don't think I have ever, that I can recall, if it has, it's been a long, long time, ever actually just clear through the Book of Lamentations. So it's somewhat familiar to me, but it's not a book that I have spent a lot of time in getting ready to teach. So we need to understand that. Now, the video you saw, and thank you, Jeremy, for getting that going for us. Appreciate that. It's the time of the exile. It is written by Jeremiah. That's the reason it's tucked into the scriptures right after Jeremiah. It's sort of the next chapter of Jeremiah. It's sort of the appendix, if you will, of that book. And we're going to look at it. So I want to just give you some basic details tonight, and then we'll get into chapter 1. By the way, if you have a good study Bible, I have one that's just basically text because I've got to have one kind of small enough to kind of manhandle when I'm preaching. But I often use a bigger study Bible when I'm studying. If you have a study Bible, many of you have them with you, it will give you this kind of an introduction. And I would encourage you, when you study a book of the Bible, take a few minutes and read that introduction. And here's some of the things it has in it. I'll do it with this. First of all, when was it written? What is the date of its writing? There is no date internal to it to tell us. It's estimated that it was likely written between 586 and 575 B.C., during or soon after Jerusalem's fall, so roughly in that same time period. Remember, in Daniel, we were talking basically in the same time period at the beginning of this Babylonian. First of all, it starts out as the Babylonian oppression, and then it becomes the Babylonian captivity. Its setting. The setting is this. The Book of Lamentations is a collection of five poems. That's the reason it's in five chapters before us. Most of our modern Bibles in English will have it set up in type so that you can at least get a hint that it is poetic in form. It's not written in paragraph form, but it's written in line form. Collection of five poems that serve as an anguished response to the destruction of Jerusalem, which occurred in 587 B.C. after a long siege by the invading Babylonian army. A lament, by the way, is basically a cry of anguish that was expressed in some sort of a form. Oftentimes in the culture of the people of the Bible, there would be a lamenting over someone who died. In our funeral traditions, generally, when we gather to visit at a funeral home for visitation or even a funeral service, for us, they're sort of quiet meetings. We talk in hushed tones, and the lights are sort of dimmed a little bit, and it's sort of trying to be comforting. In the Near East, people would cry and scream and throw dirt in the air, dirt on their heads, or tear the part of their garment just enough to people see they're in mourning. So it was a very noisy, crying out their anguish. So that is what a lament is. The author, let's talk about the author for just a moment. The Book of Lamentations does not say within the text of it that its author was Jeremiah, but tradition from very early days has been that the prophet Jeremiah is the writer of it. This view is highly likely, and I don't think there's any question, considering the author was a witness to the Babylonians destroying Jerusalem. Jeremiah fits this qualification. So even though it doesn't say written by Jeremiah on the last line or at the beginning of it, we're very, very certain that Jeremiah indeed is the earthly author, although we know that all of the Bible, God is the ultimate author, inspiring the actual human authors to write as he saw. Well, the purpose, let's talk about the purpose for just a moment. As a result of Judah's continued and unrepentant idolatry, here's what happened, and here's the purpose he gave. God allowed the Babylonians to besiege, plunder, burn, and destroy the city of Jerusalem. Solomon's temple, which had stood for about 400 years, was burned to the ground and destroyed. The prophet Jeremiah, an eyewitness to these events, wrote the book of Lamentations as a lament for that which occurred to Judah and Jerusalem. So here's the summary. Let me give you a summary. It's actually in two parts. The book of Lamentations, as we already said, is divided into five chapters. Each chapter represents one poem, a separate poem. In the original Hebrew, and unfortunately there's no way to get this into English since we are English speakers, unless you want to spend 4 or 5 years of your life and learn Hebrew, then it will make sense. But most of us, that's not going to happen. But in the original Hebrew, the verses are an acrostic. Each verse starts with a succeeding letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And I've mentioned that to you before. There are other, the Psalms have some, Proverbs has some. Remember we talked when we were on Mother's Day, we talked about Proverbs 31. That section is that sort of a thing. So the first letter, the first word of verse 1 begins with the first letter of the alphabet. First word of the second verse begins with the second letter and so forth. It's an acrostic. In the book of Lamentations, the prophet Jeremiah understands that the Babylonians were God's tool for bringing judgment upon Jerusalem. He knew that this, and you see this, you'll see this in chapter 1, he knew that God was behind it. This was not some accident, this was not some tragedy, but God was up to this. Lamentations makes it clear that sin and rebellion were the causes of God's wrath being poured out. Lamenting is appropriate in a time of distress, but it should quickly give way to contrition and repentance as we look forward to God's restoration. One thing I should mention, is there another slide? Is that the last slide? Then we go to the title slide. Okay. Let me just talk briefly about the siege of Jerusalem. We haven't really talked about that in Daniel. But you remember the first time when Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and maybe some others, were taken back to Babylon, Jerusalem was not destroyed, and that was in 606 B.C., Well, what happens then down the road, all the way down to 587, when it is destroyed, what happened? I'll give you the short story. And by the way, you can read about this in 2 Kings 25, if you want to make a note of that. That's the Bible section that would tell you about that. But basically what happens is, in 606, Nebuchadnezzar comes and lays siege to Jerusalem. The people in Jerusalem basically allow him to plunder them. Here, you take some of this good stuff, take some gold, silver, whatever. He actually plunders the temple and takes many of the sacred instruments, which were gold and silver and very precious, back to Babylon. He takes some of the nobles back, and Daniel was probably somehow connected to the royal family and the others, taken back, sort of be held as hostages, but also to be retrained and put into service back in Babylon. And then he sets up a king. He installs his own king by the name of Zedekiah, who is going to rule in Jerusalem, but also going to pay taxes, tribute they called it, back to Babylon. So rather than destroying the city, you just pay us and we'll leave your city intact. You're going to serve us now. However, Zedekiah, later, he rebels against Babylon and makes an alliance with the then Pharaoh of Egypt, Hoprat was his name. And he basically switches sides. If I can buddy up to the big bully to the south, he can keep me from getting beat up by the big bully to the east. And Nebuchadnezzar is furious at that, so he comes back, takes Jerusalem, and Zedekiah is dealt with rather severely. You can read about that in 2 Kings. And he is so angry and filled with fury and wrath. And just to make an example, you don't rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. He commanded his armies to absolutely destroy Jerusalem, destroy it, burn it, and the Temple of Solomon was absolutely leveled to the ground after it stood for 4 centuries. And most of the people were deported back to Babylon and repatriated into his country. They left a few people just to tend the land, but that's what happens. Can you imagine? I guess for us probably, if we can all remember, I think here tonight, we can remember 9/11. And we can remember how how our sensibilities were and our security was shaken. I mean, we were attacked on our soil. This wasn't some terrorist attack in some far-off place, but this was New York and Washington and the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. And I remember reading in the news that, the plane that went into the Pentagon flew right over Charleston on its way back. You know, I mean, this makes it sort of up close and personal to us. And but I've often thought, what if that plane would have crashed through the Capitol Dome rather than through into the wall of the Pentagon? Would that not just have been, I think we would have recovered and we would have still been America and we would have done what we needed to do. But can you imagine probably our most precious as a country site if that were destroyed, knocked down, and crumbled in an attack? And there's some thought that the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania was probably intended for that target or the White House one. But you can imagine what horror that would be. This is what Jeremiah saw when he saw the temple, not just a political capital, but the holy temple of God being destroyed. He saw its rock, its stones being pulled down and it being burned and being looted. And of all things, for a godly Gentile like Jeremiah, ungodly, pagan, idol-worshiping Gentiles are just running through the holy place of God. So after that fact, he takes pen in hand, inspired by the Spirit of God, and he begins writing these five poems that we know as the Book of Lamentation. And I've just entitled this one, we're just going to look at chapter 1. We'll probably pretty much cover the whole chapter. Just to make it thematically fit, we are going to jump around a little bit within the chapter, okay? So just be ready for that. It's sort of the only way I know to do it. But I've just entitled this, When Life Hurts. And here's the lesson we want to take away. Here's the lesson for us. Because life does hurt. Sometimes it just really, really hurts. He shows us how to respond to the hurts of life. It is a template that just is going to give us some advice to help us navigate the troubled waters of our own pain, our own hurt, our own disappointment, and all the havoc that sometimes life sends our way. Okay? Are you ready? Here we go. Let me just give you a little flavor of it and read a few of the verses, and then we'll pause and we'll kind of break this down into three different responses that you and I could have. And by the way, when you read poetry, you got to listen for the emotion. It's much more feeling than it is mental, okay? So let your mind engage, but let it also seep down into your emotions. Just see if you can feel this. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow is she who was great among the nations, the princes among the provinces, has become a slave. She weeps bitterly in the night. Her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into captivity, under affliction and hard servitude. She dwells among the nations. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtake her in dire straits. Verse 4. The roads to Zion mourn, because no one comes to the set feasts. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted, and she is in bitterness. Notice how he puts it in a personification. Jerusalem is described in a feminine terms, just like a person would feel, like a widow who's lost her husband and is now left destitute and in mourning. Verse 5, her adversaries have become the master. Her enemies prosper, for the Lord has afflicted her. That's the first time God enters the picture in the Book of Lamentations. It is not, fortunately, the last time. For the Lord has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. And from the daughter of Zion, all her splendor has departed. Her princes have become like deer. They find no pasture. They flee without strength before the pursuer. I'm going to stop there for a moment, and I want to just kind of break this apart. What do we learn? Well, how do we respond to hurt? Well, number one, it is okay and it is proper for us to express our sorrow back to God. It's okay to do that. God is big enough to take our expressions of our broken heart to Him. Sometimes when it comes to each other, sometimes you might not find always a listening ear when you need to express your heart to someone else. But when it comes to God, He welcomes that. There's nothing wrong with that. There's a book entitled that I received several years ago. Actually, my wife bought it for me as a birthday present. But the title of the book is called "The Land Between," and it's a study of the time when Israel was between Egypt and before they got to the Promised Land, the Exodus. Some of you that have been part of our men's Bible study, we studied that book together some time back. But the author uses this statement, because he talks about how the people complained, and then also Moses makes his complaint to God. The people were absolutely chastised by God for their complaint, but Moses' complaint was welcomed. And the author says, well, what's the difference? And here's his conclusion. I love this terminology. It is all right to complain to God. It is never all right to complain about God. We don't need to be going out and sullying His reputation and telling our disappointment. But it's okay if we come and just say, Lord, I've got a broken heart here. I'm in anguish. I'm in trouble. I need to express something to You. Now, let me just take you briefly through a few of these verses just to remind you and let you show you of how He expresses His heart. It's okay to do that. Sometimes we might think that, well, but I can't, you know, I maybe shouldn't say certain things to God. Well, when it comes to just the genuineness of the heart of one of His children, you think of one of your children if you're a parent here tonight. You welcome when your children would come and express their broken heart to you. You want them to tell what's wrong. You want to enter in. You want to give sympathy and hope and encouragement to them. God does the same. Verse 2, look at the word tears there. Her tears are on her cheeks. She's crying. It's okay to express emotion. It's part of how God built us. And this is not a psychological lesson, or this is not a psychological text. But psychologists have determined, and I think it's a pretty accurate observation of the humankind, that when we grieve, we do go through different stages of grief. By the way, you can find most of those in the book of Lamentations if you look hard enough. But here you see, he's crying. In verse 3, he uses the word unrest. She finds no rest. It's okay to express, Lord, my heart is troubled. My peace is not where it should be. I'm unsettled. There are fears and there are dark thoughts haunting the halls of my heart. If that is true of you, just tell God about it. Take it to the Lord in prayer. By the way, He's not going to be shocked. He already knows all about your condition. He knows all about the human condition. He's had plenty of practice, and He's a God who knows everything. So take it to Him. He mentions bitterness in verse 4. This sense of this, that the priests are sighing, they're afflicted, she's in bitterness, the last phrase of verse 4. And if you get something bitter, we react to it. He says, that's what life is. I'm reacting to its bitterness. I'm repulsed by the taste of what's going on in my life and my world. And he just tells God all about it. He takes it to Him. He does it also, his sorrow is also through remembering. Look at verse 7, we didn't read it, but let me just read it now. In the days of her affliction and roaming, Jerusalem remembers all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the enemy. Sometimes we love to talk about the quote-unquote good old days, don't we? Sometimes the good old days weren't as good as we remember them. And sometimes the good old days can haunt us. Oh, if I could just go back to then, if I could just go back to that situation, if I could just have that again, that which is lost to me. Well, that's part of his sorrow. It's not like it used to be. Jerusalem is a wreck. The God's people are a mess. And he pours that out to God. Look at how he described. I'm going to skip down to verse 12 here for just a moment. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? In other words, hey, everybody, look and see what I see. Do you not see what I see? Behold and see, if there's any sorrow like my sorrow, which has been brought on me, which the Lord has inflicted in the day of His fierce anger. It's just an overwhelming, unsurpassed sorrow that He brings out in this expression of His heart. Now, he understands what's caused it. It was because of God's anger, and we'll see in a little bit exactly what caused that. We've already covered one verse that explained it. But he expresses his sorrow. It's overwhelming to him. It's overpowering to him. It's really got him down. Is there any sorrow like my sorrow, which the Lord has brought on me? Verse 20, skip down there if you will. Here's another example. See, O Lord, I am in distress. My soul is troubled. My heart is overturned within me. He's describing here his heartache. We would say it that way, his heartache. And through heartache, he's just expressing this feeling. My heart is over. It's like his heart has been just kind of upset and turned over. I think all of us can tap into those feelings because we've had them on some level. Maybe not to this severity, but we've had them. We can express them back to God, and it's okay. He mentions loneliness several times. Loneliness would be a good theme for this whole chapter. He mentioned it in verse 1, how lonely sits the city. He mentions it again in verse 9, where he's speaking of this woman who's fallen into iniquity, in other words, which is Jerusalem. Her uncleanness is in her skirts. She did not consider her destiny. Therefore, her collapse was awesome. She had no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy is exalted. There's no one to come and wipe her tears. There's no one to give her empathy. All alone is pictured there. Look at verse 17. You see it again. Zion spreads out her hands. And that's a picture of one imploring. Please help. I need help. I need someone to come. It says in verse 17, Zion, which is another term for Israel, God's people. Zion spreads out her hands, but no one comforts her. The Lord has commanded concerning Jacob that those around him become his adversaries. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them. You see loneliness again down in verse 21, the next to the last verse of the poem. They have heard that I sigh, but no one comforts me. All mine enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that you have done it. Bring on the day that you have announced that they may become like me. We're hoping that God someday, that God will set things right, if you will. But notice how many times alone. Alone is not a good thing. Alone is not a good place to be. And that's part of why God gives us family, why God gives us friends, why God gives us church, a congregation to be a part of. And I thank you, for Adam, for your words, and I have found that true as well, about the sense of home here. I believe and I hear that unsolicited from many people. But I just say that to all of us. Be on guard. There's someone among us that more than likely in their heart of hearts is lonely, needing us to reach out to them. Maybe it's that person that can no longer get out to church because of age or illness. A 5-minute phone call would do more than you could ever imagine. A note written, and I know many of you do these things, and I commend you for them. But maybe it's just someone just they're here all the time. But they need a friendly voice and someone to speak to them. So loneliness is a thing. So anyway, we may express an overwhelming sorrow to God. It's okay. So here, when it comes to understanding how we handle hurts, wherever we're hurting, just tell God about it. He's big enough and strong enough, and He welcomes us. Secondly, and this gets a little more to the heart of restoration, second response we can have is this. We must learn from our mistakes. We should learn from our sins. That might be a different way of saying the same thing. But we need to look at things. There was this, and we don't know if it was just an accident or some sort of some terrorist thing, but this plane crash we hear about in the over in the Mediterranean, this Egyptian airplane that's been in the news this week. And one of the things that's going on right now, there's a race to find the black boxes. There's one that records data. There's one that records the voice of the cockpit, so they can hear what the alarms are going off in the cockpit and what the pilots are saying and so forth. And almost always in these sorts of crashes, if you can find those data recorder and that voice recorder, the investigators can piece together what happened. Was this just some sort of mechanical failure? Was this someone, planting a bomb or whatever? And I certainly don't know. But they call them black boxes. Actually, they're painted orange. I'm not sure why they're called black boxes, but they're painted orange so they can be found. They have signals that you can even find them underwater and so forth. But we want to know what caused that disaster so that we can prevent that disaster, if possible, from happening again. And there's many things that have been learned from the crashes of the past. In some sense, we need to have a bit of a recorder going in our lives. And let the Spirit of God be the investigator, and to look back at some of the tragedy and the trauma that we have caused by our own disobedience, and learn some lessons that will help us in the future and maybe help some other people in the future. And that's what he does. He reflects on some of these things. Look at verse 2 is a good example. We must learn from our mistakes. We do that by reflecting, first of all, on misplaced trust. Speaking of Jerusalem, and said in the form of a woman, he says, "She weeps bitterly in the night. Her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her." What is he talking about there? Who are these friends that dealt treacherously with her? He's really speaking about the pagan cultures and the pagan nations around. For a while, Israel thought they had an arrangement with Babylon. Then they decided they would be better off if they made an alliance with Egypt. When it all is said and done, there is no Egypt, there is no Babylon, there is no friend. All the people she trusted in have abandoned her and left her to her own outcome. They've dealt treacherously with her. Well, what do we learn from that? We need to be understanding that we cannot trust in the wrong thing and be successful in walking with the Lord. Some of you know, and some of you memorized, many of you have memorized probably the two most famous verses from the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust, and it has a phrase in there, it says, "Lean not on your own understanding." That is a misplaced trust if we think we are smart enough to navigate life without God's help and God's Word and the Spirit of God to lead us. And if we could go back to the days, if we have that in our ability to remember days before we came to know the Lord, and even in moments after we've come to know the Lord where we have just walked away from that, we know how awful that can be. He says, "In all your ways, acknowledge Him." And He promises He's going to direct our paths, our steps. What a great and gracious promise is from God. We just need to be careful that we trust in ourselves, or we trust in the knowledge and the philosophy of this world. "Oh, but Pastor, some expert I read told me that this is the way to do it." Well, you can find an expert on every subject, but there's only one book that God has written, and unfortunately, He's made it available to us. This is the starting point. And this is the evaluator of all other sources of knowledge in the world. If it conflicts with this, reject it. If it's out of harmony with this, stay away from it. And if it's not that might be something you can learn in addition, but this is the place you start with the Word of God. Reflect upon misplaced trust. Look at verse 7. We read it a little bit ago. We also need to remember the days of blessing. Remember the days of blessing. She says, "In the days of her affliction and roaming, Jerusalem remembers all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old when her people fell into the hand of the enemy." That's all gone now. You remember the story that Jesus told, the parable, the account, if you will, of the prodigal son? He goes to his father and says, "You know, I want you to give me my inheritance." That was very improper, very insulting. Basically, he's telling his father, "You're not dying soon enough, so give me what I want now." It was very disrespectful. His father gives him his inheritance. He goes out and squanders it in all sorts of horrible, sinful living. And when it's all gone, the only job he can get, and this is a Jewish boy, the only job he can get is feeding the hogs, and the hogs are eating better than he is. That's about as far down as you can get. And suddenly he remembers, in my father's house, there are servants, there are slaves that at least have a good meal on the table every day. And he says, "I'll go back and I'll just hire myself on. He won't consider me a son anymore, but I'll go back and I'll be one of his hired servants and just work. At least I'll have food to assuage my hunger." It was interesting that in the hog pen, Daddy's house looked a lot better than it did when he started down the trail that led to the hog pen. "I've had enough of this. I've had enough of living this way. I've had enough of these rules. I've had enough of whatever it was that was on his mind. Just give me my money and I'm going to go live it up." But suddenly he reflects back on the good days, how good it was and how blessed it was. The great thing is for you and I, we can turn around short of the hog pen. I mean, he could have got half a mile down the road and said, "You know what? I must be out of my mind. What am I doing? I'm going to go back and ask my dad forgiveness and just be restored." He could have done it anywhere when the party cycle was going on, when people were just draining his his resources and draining his life. He could have stopped anywhere. You don't have to get to the hog pen to turn around. You can do it at any point. But we need to look back. We need to do some diagnostics here in our lives. Verse 9, we can recall a forgotten destiny. I'm going to read all the very end of verse 7. It says, with no one to help her, the adversary saw her and mocked her at her downfall. And then I'm going to skip to verse 9. We've already looked at it, but talk about this forgotten destiny, okay? Her uncleanness in her skirts, she did not consider her destiny. Her destiny is what God determined and desired for Israel to be. What did God desire for Israel to be? A shining light to this world. To tell everybody that there is one God, and He is to be loved and to serve, and He wants to do amazing things to people. And they were to be an instrument of evangelism. Instead, they were corrupted by the world, and they got into all sorts of idolatry, and she forgot what she was here for. We need to recall what sometimes we forget as well. What is our destiny? We're here to glorify God. We are, as a church, to fulfill the Great Commission to produce disciples. If you want to know what the product that we're producing, it's simply that, followers of Christ. And then we need to react to the holy being corrupted. Look at verse 10 and 11. The adversary has spread his hand over her pleasant things, and she has seen the nations enter into her sanctuary, those whom you commanded not to enter your assembly. All her people sigh and seek bread. They have given their valuables for food to restore life. See, O Lord, consider, for I am scorned. How awful and corrupt everything is now. How things are just in trouble. We need to be willing to learn from our mistakes and remind ourselves when it comes those moments of temptation yet future, let that push us back in the way of righteousness. And let our example serve as a warning to other people. And I've had people that have testified to me and probably done a more service than I realize just by saying, don't do what I've done. Avoid this mess that I've got in my life, and I don't want this the same for you. Good warnings that are given. But thirdly, must express an overwhelming sorrow. We may do that. We must learn from our mistakes. And lastly, we must have through it all, this is kind of the underlying hope here, an underlying confidence in God. Even in spite of his heartbreak, you find him still trusting in God and knowing God's up to something. Well, how does that work? Well, we do it as we confess our sins to him. There's a lot of confession goes on in the book of Lamentations. Verse 8 is one example. We just read it. Jerusalem has sinned gravely, therefore she has become vile. All who honored her despise her because they've seen her nakedness. Yes, she sighs and turns away. I don't think we had read that one, actually. Notice he says it's because of our sin we're there. Then in verse 20, he mentions again, see, O Lord, I am in distress. My soul is troubled. My heart is overturned, for I have been very rebellious. Outside the sword bereaves. At home, it is like death. Like death. He says, notice how in that verse, he makes it personal. It's not just a general confession. Oh, well, this is a bad people, bad land, bad followers. But he makes it very personal where he says, I have been very rebellious. This confidence comes that when we confess our sins to God, God is in the business of forgiving and restoring. If I told you nothing else but that, that should be enough to encourage all of us, that God will forgive and God will restore no matter where we've been, no matter where we are. You remember the prodigal son? He was not made a slave in his father's house. His father comes and embraces him as a son and has a great celebration and all that. Everybody but the older brother, who, by the way, pictured the Pharisees, and you can study that at another time. But everybody but the older brother was excited. This son who was lost has now been found, the lost son. God welcomed, in that person, the father welcomes him back in. Not only do this confidence in God come when we just say, Lord, I know you'll forgive, but it also comes by recognizing that the Lord's chastisement is for a purpose. A couple places you see that there. And actually, it's an extended section. It goes from verses 12 all the way through verse 15. Let me give you just a sample of it. I'm going to pick it up in verse 14. The yoke of my transgressions was bound. They were woven together by his hands, this is God's hands, and thrust upon my neck. He, God, made my strength fail. The Lord delivered me into the hands of those whom I'm not able to withstand. The Lord has trampled underfoot all my mighty men in the midst. He has called an assembly against me to crush my young men. The Lord trampled as a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah. For these things I weep, my eye overflows with water, because the comforter who should restore my life is far from me. My children are desolate because the enemy prevailed. We read verse 17 about spreading out her hands and no one came. He recognizes God has brought to bear this horrible set of circumstances to get them to wake up and come back to Him. The one thing that occurred, the one wonderful thing that occurred by the Babylonian exile, and how God did it, He did it. But when Israel finally returns to the land, this remnant returns to the land, Ezra, Nehemiah, those are the books that kind of peg that time in history. When the Persians take over the Babylonian Empire, they have a different program. They let the people, rather than keep them in exile, you go back to your land and you do something productive there. This remnant of Israel goes back to the land. They never ever again toyed with paganism and toyed with idolatry like they did in the Old Testament. Now, they had other sets of problems. When the New Testament opens, we see the problems there. But idolatry was shaken out of them, and that never, ever rears its head again. Thirdly, as we recognize God's righteousness, look at verse 18. The Lord is righteous, for I rebelled against His commands. Hear now, O people, and behold my sorrow. My virgins, my young men have gone into captivity. He's simply saying this. And this is what we need to say when God brings trouble into our lives that we've caused because of our own disobedience. Lord, You've done a good thing. You be praised even for the chastisement that You bring. You know, if you were raised by parents that disciplined you to try to keep you straight, maybe when you were a youngster, you didn't really appreciate the discipline you received. By the time you reach adulthood, you become a little more thankful that your parents cared enough that they tried to keep you in a path that was very helpful for you rather than where you zoomed off, could have zoomed off, and maybe did zoom off. But God is in the business. Whom the Lord loves, He chastens, the Bible says. And we can have confidence in one more thing, and this is down in verse 20, and I'll read these last three verses of the chapter. See, O Lord, that I am in distress. My soul is troubled. My heart is overturned within me, for I have been very rebellious. Outside, the sword bereaves. At home, it is like death. They have heard that I sigh, but no one comforts me. All my enemies have heard my trouble. They're glad that you have done it. Bring on the day that You've announced that they may become like me, that all their wickedness come before You, and do to them as You have done to me for all my transgressions. For my sighs are many, and my heart is faint. He cries out for relief, and that's the fourth way we express our confidence. We cry out for relief. He's crying out for his own heart's situation, and he cries out that someday God will bring all things back to a point of restoration. The hurts of life. Now, the hurts here that we're looking at in Lamentations were caused by their disobedience. Some hurts, like the book of Job, is a record of hurts that come that have nothing to do with disobedience. But nonetheless, we learn that it's okay to cry out to Him. We can learn from these things, and through it all, we can just have a rock-solid confidence in our God. I'll leave you with this statement. The hurts of life are intended and can bring us closer to God if we walk with Him and look to Him in all things.